to tell, and I will make this confession as frankly as the rest. I have always disliked common prostitutes. However, at Venice there was nothing else within my reach, since my position excluded me from most of the distinguished houses in the city. Monsieur Leblanc's daughters were very amiable, but very reserved. Besides, I had too much respect for their father and mother, even to think of desiring them. A young person named Mademoiselle de Cataneo, daughter of the agent of the King of Prussia, would have been more to my taste, but Cario was in love with her. Even marriage had been talked of. He was well-to-do, while I had nothing. His salary was 100 louis, mine only 100 pistoles. And not to mention that I had no wish to poach on a friend's preserves, I knew that a man had no right to enter upon affairs of gallantry with a poorly filled purse, wherever he was, especially in Venice. I had not lost the pernicious habit of satisfying my wants, and, being too much occupied to feel keenly those which the climate causes, I lived nearly a year in Venice as chastely as I'd lived in Paris, and I left it at the end of 18 months without having had anything to do with women, except twice, in consequence of special opportunities, which I will mention. The first was provided for me by that honourable gentleman, Vitale, some time after the formal apology which I forced him to make to me. At table, the conversation turned upon the amusements of Venice. The company reproached me for my indifference to the most piquant of all, and extolled the graceful manners of the Venetian women, declaring that they had not their equals in the world. Domenico said that I must make the acquaintance of the most amiable of all. He expressed himself ready to introduce me, and assured me that I should be delighted with her. I began to laugh at this obliging offer, and Count Peati, an old man of high character, said, with greater frankness than I should have expected from an Italian, that he considered me too sensible to allow myself to be taken to see a woman by my enemy. In fact, I had neither the intention nor the inclination. But in spite of this, by one of those inconsistencies which I can hardly understand myself, I ended by allowing myself to be dragged there, against my inclination, heart and reason, and even against my will, simply from weakness and shame of exhibiting mistrust. And, in the language of the country, per non parer troppo coglione, in order not to appear too great a blockhead. The Padoana, to whose house we went, was good-looking, even handsome, but her beauty was not of the kind that pleased me. Domenico left me with her. I sent for Sorbetti, asked her to sing to me, and at the end of half an hour I put a ducat on the table and prepared to go. But she was so singularly scrupulous that she refused to take it without having earned it, and with equally singular foolishness I satisfied her scruples. I returned to the palace feeling so convinced that I'd caught some complaint that the first thing I did was to send for the physician and ask him to give me some medicine. Nothing can equal the feeling of depression from which I suffered for 3 weeks, without any real inconvenience, or the appearance of any symptoms to justify it. I could not imagine that it was possible to get off unscathed from the embraces of the Padoana. Even the physician had the greatest trouble imaginable to reassure me. He only succeeded by persuading me that I was formed in a peculiar manner, which lessened the chance of infection. And although I have perhaps exposed myself to this risk less than any other man, the fact that I have never suffered in this respect seems to prove that the physician was right. However, this belief has never made me imprudent, and if nature has really bestowed this advantage upon me, I can declare that I have never abused it. My other adventure, although with a woman also, was of a very different kind, both in its origin and consequences. I had mentioned that Capitaine Olivet invited me to dinner on board, and that I took with me the secretary of the Spanish embassy. I expected a salute of cannon. The crew received us, drawn up in line, but not a grain of priming was burnt. This mortified me greatly, on account of Cario, who I saw was a little annoyed at it. Certainly on merchant ships, people by no means as important as ourselves were received with a salute of cannon. And besides, I thought that I had deserved some mark of distinction from the captain. I was unable to conceal my feelings, a thing which I have never been able to do, and although the dinner was a very good one, and Olivier did the honours admirably, I began it in an ill humour, eating little, and speaking still less. When the first health was drunk, I expected at least a volley. Nothing of the kind. Cario, who read my thoughts, laughed to see me sulking like a child. Before the dinner was half over, I saw a gondola approaching. "Faith," said the captain to me, "take care of yourself. Here comes the enemy." I asked him what he meant, and he answered with a jest. The gondola lay to, and I saw a dazzlingly beautiful young woman step out, coquettishly dressed and very nimble. In three bounds she was in the cabin and seated at my side, before I perceived that a place had been laid for her. She was a brunette of 20 years at the most, as charming as she was lively. She could only speak Italian. Her accent alone would have been enough to turn my head. While eating and chatting, she fixed her eyes upon me, and then, exclaiming, "Oh, Holy Virgin! Oh, my dear Bremont! How long is it since I saw you?" She threw herself into my arms, pressed her lips close to mine, and squeezed me almost to suffocation. Her large, black, oriental eyes darted shafts of fire into my heart, and although surprise at first caused me some disturbance, my amorous feelings so rapidly overcame me that, in spite of the spectators, the fair enchantress was herself obliged to restrain me. I was intoxicated, or rather delirious. When she saw me worked up to the pitch she desired, she moderated her caresses, but not her liveliness, and when she thought fit to explain to us the true or pretended reason of her forwardness, she told us that I was the very image of one Monsieur de Bremont, a director of the Tuscan custom-house, that she had been, and still was, madly in love with him, that she had left him because she was a fool, that she took me in his place, that she wanted to love me since it suited her, that, in like manner, I must love her as long as it suited her, and when she left me in the lurch, bear it patiently, as her dear Bremont had done. No sooner said than done. She took possession of me as if I'd belonged to her, gave me her gloves to take care of, her fan, her girdle, and her headgear. Another interpretation of the word girdle, suggested, is bouquet. She ordered me to go here and there, to do this and that, and I obeyed. She told me to send back her gondola because she wanted to use mine, and I did so. She told me to change places with Cario because she had something to say to him, and I did so. They talked together for a long time in a low voice, and I did not disturb them. She called me. I went back to her. "Listen, Zanetto," she said to me, "I do not want to be loved in French fashion. Indeed, it would lead to no good. The moment you are tired, go. But do not stop halfway, I warn you." After dinner we went to see the glass manufactory at Murano. She bought several little knick-knacks, which without ceremony she left us to pay for. But she everywhere gave away in gratuities much more than we spent altogether. From the carelessness with which she threw away her money and allowed us to throw away our own, it was easy to see that she attached no value to it. When she demanded payment for herself, I believe it was more out of vanity than greed. She was flattered by the price men put upon her favours. In the evening we escorted her back to her apartments. While we were talking, I noticed two pistols on her dressing-table. "Ah," said I, taking one up, "here is a beauty-spot box of new manufacture. May I ask what it is used for? I know you have other weapons which fire better than these." After some pleasantries of the same kind, she said, with an ingenuous pride which made her still more charming, "When I am good-natured to those for whom I have no affection, I make them pay for the weariness which they cause me. Nothing can be fairer, but although I endure their caresses, I will not endure their insults, and I shall not miss the first man who shall show himself wanting in respect to me." When I left her, I made an appointment for the next day. I did not keep her waiting. I found her in a more than wanton déshabillé, which is only known in southern countries, and which I will not amuse myself with describing, although I remember it only too well. I will only say that her ruffles and tucker were edged with a silk border, ornamented with rose-coloured bows, which appeared to me to set off a very beautiful skin. I discovered later that this was the fashion at Venice, and the effect is so charming that I'm surprised that it has never been introduced into France. I had no idea of the pleasures which awaited me. I have spoken of Madame de Larnage in the transport which the recollection of her sometimes still awakens in me. But how old, ugly, and cold she was compared to my Zulietta! Do not attempt to imagine the charms and graces of this bewitching girl. You would be far from the truth. The young virgins of the cloister are not so fresh. The beauties of the harem are not so lively. The houris of paradise are not so piquant. Never was such sweet enjoyment offered to the heart and senses of mortal man. Ah, if only I had known how to taste of it in its full completeness, at least for a single moment. I tasted it, it is true, but without charm. I gulled all its delights. I killed them, as it were, intentionally. No, nature has not created me for enjoyment. She has put into my wretched head the poison of that ineffable happiness, the desire for which he has planted in my heart. If there is one circumstance in my life which well describes my character, it is that which I am about to relate. The vividness with which at this moment I recall the purpose of my book will, in this place, make me forget the false feeling of delicacy which would prevent me from fulfilling it. Whoever you may be who desire to know the inmost heart of a man, have the courage to read the next two or three pages. You will become thoroughly acquainted with Jean-Jacques Rousseau. I entered the room of a courtesan as if it had been the sanctuary of love and beauty. In her person I thought I beheld its divinity. I should never have believed that, without respect and esteem, I could have experienced the emotions with which she inspired me. No sooner had I recognized, in the preliminary familiarities, the value of her charms and caresses than, for fear of losing the fruit of them in advance, I was anxious to make haste to pluck it. Suddenly, in place of the flame which consumed me, I felt a deathly chill run through my veins. My legs trembled under me, and, feeling ready to faint, I sat down and cried like a child. Who would guess the reason of my tears and the thoughts that passed through my head at that moment? I said to myself, "This object, which is at my disposal, is the masterpiece of nature and love, its mind and body, every part of it, perfect. She is as good and generous as she is amiable and beautiful. The great ones of the world ought to be her slaves. Scepters ought to be laid at her feet. And yet she is a miserable streetwalker, on sale to everybody. A merchant captain has the disposal of her. She comes and throws herself at my head, mine, although she knows that I am poor, while my real merits, being unknown to her, can have no value in her eyes. In this there is something incomprehensible. Either my heart deceives me, dazzles my senses, and makes me the dupe of a worthless slut, or some secret defect, with which I am unacquainted, must destroy the effect of her charms and render her repulsive to those who would otherwise fight for the possession of her. I began to look for this defect with a singular intensity of mind, and it never occurred to me that the possible consequences of having anything to do with her might possibly have something to do with it. The freshness of her skin, her brilliant complexion, her dazzlingly white teeth, the sweetness of her breath, the general air of cleanliness about her whole person, so completely banished this idea from my mind that, being still in doubt as to my condition since my visit to the Paduana, I rather felt qualms of conscience as to whether I was in sufficiently good health for her, and I am quite convinced that I was not deceived in my confidence. These well-timed reflections so agitated me that I shed tears. Zulietta, for whom this was certainly quite a novel sight under the circumstances, was astounded for a moment. But after having walked round the room and looked in her glass, she understood, and my eyes convinced her that dislike had nothing to do with this whimsical melancholy. It was an easy matter for her to drive it away, and to efface the slight feeling of shame. But at the moment when I was ready to sink exhausted upon a bosom, which seemed to permit for the first time the contact of a man's hand and mouth, I perceived that she had only one nipple. I smote my forehead, looked attentively, and thought I saw that this nipple was not formed like the other. I immediately began to rack my brains for the reason of such a defect, and feeling convinced that it was connected with some remarkable natural imperfection, by brooding so long over this idea, I saw, as clear as daylight, that in the place of the most charming person that I could picture to myself, I only held in my arms a kind of monster, the outcast of nature, of mankind, and of love. I pushed my stupidity so far as to speak to her about this defect. At first she took it as a joke, and said and did things in her frolicsome humour, which were enough to make me die of love. But as I was unable to conceal from her that I still felt a certain amount of uneasiness, she at last blushed, adjusted her dress, got up, and without saying a word went and seated herself at the window. I wanted to sit by her side, but she moved, sat down on a couch, got up immediately afterwards, and walking about the room and fanning herself, said to me in a cold and disdainful tone, "Zanetto, lascia le donne e studia le matematica." "Give up the ladies and study mathematics." Before I left, I begged her to grant me another interview on the following day. She postponed it till the third day, adding, with an ironical smile, that I must want rest. I spent this interval very ill at ease, my heart full of her charms and graces, sensible of my folly, with which I reproached myself, regretting the moments which I had so ill employed, which it had only rested with myself to make the sweetest moments of my life, awaiting with the most lively impatience the time when I might repair their loss. But nevertheless, still uneasy in spite of myself, how I should reconcile the perfections of this adorable girl with her unworthy manner of life. I ran, I flew to her at the appointed hour. I do not know whether her ardent temperament would have been more satisfied with this visit. Her pride at least would have been flattered, and I enjoyed in anticipation the delight of proving to her, in every respect, that I knew how to repair my errors. She spared me the test. The gondolier whom I sent to her apartments on landing informed me that she had set out for Florence on the previous evening. If I had not felt my whole love for her when I had her in my arms, I felt it cruelly now, when I'd lost her. My foolish regret has never left me. Amiable and enchanting as she was in my eyes, I could have consoled myself for the loss of her. But I confess that I have never been able to console myself for the thought that she only carried away a contemptuous recollection of me. Such were my two adventures. The 18 months which I spent at Venice have left me no more to tell, with the exception of a merely projected amour. Cario, who was very fond of women, tired of always visiting those who belonged to others, took it into his head to keep one himself. And, as we were inseparable, he proposed to me an arrangement, common enough in Venice, that we should keep one between us. I agreed. The difficulty was to find one with whom we should run no risk. He was so industrious in his researches that he unearthed a little girl between 11 and 12 years of age, whom her unworthy mother wanted to sell. We went together to see her. My compassion was stirred at the sight of this child. She was fair and gentle as a lamb. No one would have taken her for an Italian. Living costs little at Venice. We gave the mother some money and made arrangements for the daughter's keep. She had a good voice, and in order to provide her with a means of livelihood, we gave her a spinet and engaged a singing master for her. All this scarcely cost us 2 sequins a month, and saved more in other expenses. But as we were obliged to wait until she was of a riper age, this was sowing a long time before we could reap. However, we were content to pass our evenings, to chat and play innocently with this child, and amused ourselves perhaps more agreeably than if we had possessed her. So true is it that what most attaches us to women is not so much sensuality as a certain pleasure which is caused by living with them. My heart became insensibly attached to the little Anzoletta, but this attachment was paternal. My senses had so little to do with it that, in proportion as it increased, the possibility of allowing them to have any influence in like manner diminished. I felt that I should have dreaded connection with this child, after she had grown up, as an abominable incest. I saw that the worthy Cario's feelings, unknown to himself, took the same direction. We procured for ourselves, without thinking of it, pleasures as delightful, though very different from those we had originally contemplated, and I am convinced that, however beautiful she might have grown, far from being the corruptors of her innocence, we should have been its protectors. The subsequent change in my affairs, which took place shortly afterwards, did not leave me time to take part in this good work, and I have nothing for which to commend myself in this matter except the inclinations of my heart. Let me now return to my journey. My first intention on leaving Monsieur de Montaigu was to retire to Geneva until happier circumstances should have removed the obstacles which prevented me from rejoining my poor mamma. But the stir which our quarrel had caused, and the ambassador's folly in writing to the court about it, made me resolve to go there in person to give an account of my own conduct, and to lodge a complaint against that of a madman. From Venice I communicated my resolution to Monsieur du Tail, who, after Monsieur Amelot's death, had been provisionally charged with the conduct of foreign affairs. I set out immediately after my letter, travelling by way of Bergamo, Como, and Duomo d'Ossola, and crossing the Simplon. Arrived at Sion, Monsieur de Chagnon, the French chargé d'affaires, gave me a most kindly reception. At Geneva, Monsieur de la Closure did the same. I there renewed my acquaintance with Monsieur de Gaufrecourt, from whom I had to receive some money. I had passed through Nyon without seeing my father. Not that it did not cost me a severe pang, but I had been unable to make up my mind to present myself to my stepmother after my ill luck, feeling sure that she would condemn me unheard. Duvillard, an old friend of my father, reproached me severely for this neglect. I explained the reason of it, and in order to repair it without exposing myself to the risk of meeting my stepmother, I hired a carriage, and we went to Nyon together and got down at the inn. Duvillard went to fetch my poor father, who came in all haste to embrace me. We supped together, and after having spent a most delightful evening, I returned on the following morning to Geneva with Duvillard, to whom I have always felt grateful for the kindness which he showed me on this occasion. My shortest route was not by way of Lyon, but I wanted to pass through it in order to satisfy myself in regard to a very mean trick of Monsieur de Montaigu. I had had a small chest sent to me from Paris containing a gold-embroidered waistcoat, some pairs of ruffles, and 6 pairs of white silk stockings. That was all. On his own proposal I ordered this chest, or rather box, to be added to his luggage. In the apothecary's bill, which he wanted to make me take in payment of my salary, and which he had written out himself, he had set down the weight of this box, which he called a bale, as 1,100 weight, and had charged the carriage of it to me at an enormous rate. Thanks to the exertions of Monsieur Bois de la Tour, to whom I had been recommended by his uncle, Monsieur Roquin, it was proved from the custom-house registers of Lyon and Marseille that the bale in question only weighed 45 pounds, and that the carriage had been charged accordingly. I added this authentic extract to Monsieur de Montaigu's bill, and armed with this and other evidence equally strong, I repaired to Paris, full of impatience to make use of it. During the whole of this long journey, I had little adventures at Como, in Valais, and other places. Amongst other things, I saw the Borromean Islands, which are worth describing. But time presses. I am surrounded by spies, and I am obliged to accomplish, inefficiently and in haste, a task which would require peace of mind and leisure, which I do not enjoy. Should Providence ever deign to cast its eyes upon me, and at last grant me a less troubled existence, I am determined to employ it in recasting this work, if possible, or at least in adding a supplement, which I feel it greatly needs. I have now abandoned this idea. The report of my story had preceded me, and on my arrival I found that everyone, both in the offices and in public, was scandalized at the ambassador's follies. But in spite of this, in spite of the public outcry in Venice, in spite of the unanswerable proofs which I produced, I was unable to obtain justice. In fact, far from getting either satisfaction or reparation, I was even left to the tender mercies of the ambassador for my salary, simply because, not being a Frenchman, I had no claim to the protection of the nation. And it was a private matter that concerned only our two selves. Everyone agreed with me that I was insulted, injured, and unfortunate, that the ambassador was outrageously foolish, cruel, and unjust, and that the whole affair was a lasting disgrace to him. But he was the ambassador. I was only the secretary. Good order, or that which is so called, required that I should not obtain justice, and I did not obtain it. I imagined that, by continued complaints, and by publicly treating this fool as he deserved, I should at last make people tell me to hold my tongue, which was just what I was waiting for, since I was firmly resolved not to obey until I had obtained justice. But at that time there was no Minister of Foreign Affairs. Others permitted, even encouraged me to make an outcry, and joined in the chorus. But the matter never proceeded further, until at length, tired of being always in the right, and never obtaining justice, I became disheartened and let it drop. The only person who received me coldly, and from whom I should least have expected this unfair treatment, was Madame de Besenval. With her head full of the privileges conferred by rank and nobility, she could not understand that an ambassador could ever be wrong in his dealings with his secretary. The manner of her reception was in accord with this prejudice. I was so annoyed at it that, after leaving her house, I wrote to her one of the strongest and most violent letters that I have perhaps ever written, and I never went to her house again. Father Castel made me more welcome, but at the bottom of his Jesuitical wheedling, I saw that he followed faithfully one of the grand principles of his society, always to sacrifice the weaker to the stronger. The lively consciousness of the justice of my cause, and my natural pride, did not allow me to endure this partisanship patiently. I gave up visiting Father Castel, and consequently the Jesuits, amongst whom I knew no one but himself. Besides, the tyrannical and intriguing disposition of his colleagues, so different from the amiability of good Father Aimé, caused me to feel such an aversion to their society that since then I have never seen any of them except Father Berthier, whom I met two or three times at Monsieur Dupin's, together with whom he was working with all his might at the refutation of Montesquieu. Let me finish, once for all, what I still have to say concerning Monsieur de Montaigu. I had told him, in the course of our disputes, that he did not want a secretary but a lawyer's clerk. He followed this advice, and actually engaged, as my successor, a real attorney, who in less than a year robbed him of 20,000 or 30,000 livres. He dismissed him, and had him imprisoned, discharged his gentlemen in a manner that caused great scandal, quarrelled with everyone, put up with affronts that a lackey would not have endured, and at last, by his repeated acts of folly, succeeded in getting himself recalled and sent into retirement in the country. Amongst the reprimands which he received from the court, his affair with me was apparently not forgotten. At any rate, shortly after his return, he sent his maître d'hôtel to me to settle my account and give me some money, which I sorely needed at the time, for my debts at Venice? Debts of honour, if there ever were such, weighed heavily upon my mind. I seized the opportunity which was afforded me of discharging them, together with Zanetto Nanni's bill. I took what was offered to me, paid all my debts, and although this left me as penniless as before, I was relieved from a burden which had become unendurable to me. Since then I never heard a word about Monsieur de Montaigu until his death, which I learned through the newspapers. Heaven rest the poor man. He was as fit for the trade of an ambassador as, in my youth, I had been for that of an attorney. However, it had only rested with him to have maintained himself honourably with my assistance, and to have ensured my speedy promotion in the position for which the Comte de Gouvon had designed me in my youth, and which, by my own exertions at a more advanced age, I had qualified myself to fulfil. The justice and uselessness of my complaints left in my mind the seeds of indignation against our foolish civil institutions, whereby the real welfare of the public and true justice are always sacrificed to an apparent order, which is in reality subversive of all order, and of which the only effect is to bestow the sanction of public authority upon the oppression of the weak and the injustice of the strong. Two causes prevented these seeds from developing at that time, as they did afterwards. In the first place, it was a matter that concerned myself, and private interest, which has never produced anything great or noble, cannot draw from my heart the divine flights which only the purest love of the just and the beautiful can produce. In the second place, the charm of friendship moderated and calmed my anger, by the ascendancy of a gentler feeling. At Venice I had made the acquaintance of a Biscayan, a friend of my friend Cario, and a person who deserved the friendship of every honourable man. This amiable young man, endowed with every accomplishment and virtue, had just travelled through Italy in order to cultivate a taste for the fine arts, and thinking that he had nothing further to learn, intended to return direct to his own country. I told him that the arts were merely the recreation of a genius like his, which was made to cultivate the sciences. And I advised him, in order to acquire a taste for these, to take a journey to Paris and stay there for 6 months. He believed what I said, and on my arrival at Paris I found him waiting for me. His apartments were too large for him. He offered to share them with me, and I accepted. I found him full of enthusiasm for the higher branches of knowledge. Nothing was beyond his powers of comprehension. He devoured and digested everything with marvellous rapidity. How he thanked me for having provided him with this nourishment for his mind, which was tormented by a thirst after knowledge, without his being aware of it himself. What treasures of knowledge and virtue did I find in this vigorous soul? I felt that this was the friend I needed. We became intimate. Our tastes were not the same, we were always disputing. Both obstinate, we could never agree on a single subject. Notwithstanding, we were unable to separate, and although we perpetually contradicted each other, neither of us would have wished the other to be different. Ignazio Emanuel de Altuna was one of those rare individuals whom Spain alone produces, too seldom for her own glory. He was not a man of the violent national passions common to his countrymen. The idea of revenge was as far from his mind as the desire of it from his heart. He was too proud to be vindictive, and I have often heard him say, with great sang-froid, that no living man could offend him. He was gallant, without being tender. He played with women as if they had been pretty children. He amused himself with his friends' mistresses, but I never knew him to have one himself, or even to desire it. The flames of the virtue which consumed his heart never suffered the passions of desire to become excited. After his travels, he married, died young, and left children. And I am as convinced as I am of my own conscience that his wife was the first and only woman with whom he enjoyed the pleasures of love. Outwardly, He was devout, like a Spaniard. In his heart he had the piety of an angel. With the exception of myself, he is the only tolerant person I've ever seen in my life. He never asked anyone what his religious views were. It made little difference to him whether his friend was a Jew, Protestant, Turk, bigot, or atheist, provided he was an honest man, obstinate and headstrong in matters of little importance. The moment religion, or even morality, became the subject of discussion, he drew back, held his tongue, or simply said, "I have only myself to answer for." It is incredible that so elevated a mind could be associated with an attention to detail carried to minuteness. He divided and settled in advance the occupations of his day, by hours, quarters, and minutes, and he adhered so scrupulously to this arrangement that, if the hour struck while he was in the middle of a sentence, he would have shut the book without finishing it. Each of these portions of time, thus broken up, was set apart for a different occupation. Reflection, conversation, divine service, Locke, telling his beads, visiting, music, painting. No pleasure, temptation, or desire to oblige was permitted to interrupt this arrangement. Only a duty to be fulfilled could have done so. When he gave me the list of his distribution of time, in order that I might follow it, I began by laughing and ended with tears of admiration. He never bored others or suffered them to bore him. He was somewhat abrupt with those who, out of politeness, attempted to do so. He was hot-tempered, but not sulky. I've often seen him in a passion, but never angry. Nothing could be more cheerful than his disposition. He knew how to make and take a joke. He was even brilliant in this respect, and had a talent for epigram. When anyone roused him, he was loud and noisy, and his voice could be heard at a distance. But whilst he exclaimed loudly, one could see him smile, and in the midst of his excitement he would utter some pleasantry, which made everyone burst out laughing. He had neither the phlegmatic disposition nor the complexion of a Spaniard. His skin was white, his cheeks ruddy, his hair light brown, almost fair. He was tall and well-built. His body was a worthy habitation for his soul. This man, wise in heart as in understanding, was a man of the world and was my friend. This is my only answer to those who are not. We became so intimate that we formed the intention of spending our lives together. It was agreed that in a few years I should go and live with him on his estate at Azcoitia. All the details of this plan were arranged between us the day before he left. Nothing was wanting, except that which does not depend upon men in the best concerted plans. Later events, my misfortunes, his marriage, and lastly his death, separated us forever. One would feel inclined to say that only the dark schemes of the wicked succeed, that the innocent projects of the good are hardly ever fulfilled. Having felt the inconvenience of dependence, I firmly resolved never to expose myself to it again, having seen the ambitious projects which circumstances had caused me to form, overthrown almost at their birth, discouraged from again entering the career which I had begun so successfully, and from which, notwithstanding, I had just been driven. I resolved never to attach myself to anyone again, but to remain independent, by making the best use of my talents, the extent of which I was at last beginning to appreciate, and of which I had hitherto entertained too modest an opinion. I resumed work at my opera, which had been discontinued owing to my journey to Venice. And in order to devote myself to it with less interruption, after Altoona's departure, I returned to my old lodgings at the Hotel Saint-Quentin, which was situated in an unfrequented quarter of the city, close to the Luxembourg, and was better suited for quiet work than the noisy Rue Saint-Honoré. There, the only real consolation, which heaven has afforded me in my misery, and which alone renders it endurable, awaited me. As this is no passing acquaintance, I must enter in some detail upon the manner in which it was formed. We had a new landlady, who came from Orléans. To help her with the linen, she had a young girl from her native place, about 22 or 23 years of age, who, like the landlady, took her meals with us. This girl, whose name was Thérèse Levasseur, was of respectable family, her father being an official at the Orléans Mint, and her mother engaged in business. The family was a large one, and as the mint stopped working, the father found himself without resources, while the mother, who had become bankrupt, managed her affairs badly, gave up business, and came to Paris with her husband and daughter, who, by her own exertions, supported all three. The first time I saw this girl appear at table, I was struck by her modest behaviour, and still more by her lively and gentle looks, which, in my eyes, at that time appeared incomparable. The company at table, besides Monsieur de Bonnefond, consisted of several Irish priests, Gascons, and others of the same description. Our hostess herself had led an irregular life. I was the only person who spoke and behaved decently. They teased the girl, I took her part, and immediately their railleries were turned against me. Even if I had not felt naturally inclined towards this poor girl, a feeling of compassion, even of opposition, would have aroused my sympathy. I have always admired decency in words and manners, especially in the opposite sex. I openly avowed myself her champion. I saw that she was touched by my sympathy, and her looks, enlivened by gratitude, which she dared not express, were thereby rendered more eloquent. She was very bashful, and so was I. The intimacy, which this similarity of disposition seemed to keep at a distance, was, however, very speedily formed. The landlady, who perceived it, became furious, and her brutal behaviour gained me greater favour with the little one, who, having no one in the house except myself to help her, was grieved to see me go out, and sighed for her protector's return. The relation of our hearts and the similarity of our dispositions soon exercised their usual effect. She thought that she saw in me an honourable man, and she was not mistaken. I thought that I saw in her a feeling, simple girl, free from coquetry, and I was not deceived either. I declared to her beforehand that I would never forsake her, but that I would never marry her. Love, esteem, and simple sincerity secured my triumph, and it was because her heart was tender and virtuous that I was happy without being too audacious. Her fear that it would annoy me not to find in her that which she believed I expected delayed my happiness more than anything else. I saw that she was disturbed and confused before she gave herself up to me, anxious to make herself understood, and yet afraid to explain herself. Far from suspecting the real cause of her embarrassment, I quite wrongly attributed it to another, the idea of which was highly insulting to her character. Believing that she intended me to understand that my health might be endangered, I was greatly perplexed, and although this did not restrain my feelings, for several days it poisoned my happiness. As neither of us understood the other, our conversations on the subject were so many riddles and ridiculous misunderstandings. She was inclined to believe that I was utterly mad, and I hardly knew what to think of her. At last we came to an explanation. She confessed to me with tears that she had once misconducted herself in the early years of her womanhood, when a cunning seducer had taken advantage of her ignorance. As soon as I understood her, I uttered a cry of joy. "Virginity," I cried. "Paris is the right place. 20 is the right age to look for it. Ah, my Thérèse, I am only too happy to possess you, modest and healthy, and not to find what I never looked for." At first I had only sought amusement. I now saw that I had found more and gained a companion. A little intimacy with this excellent girl, a little reflection upon my situation, made me feel that, while thinking only of my pleasures, I had done much to promote my happiness. To supply the place of my extinguished ambition, I needed a lively sentiment which should take complete possession of my heart. In a word, I needed a successor to Mama. As I should never live with her again, I wanted someone to live with her pupil, in whom I might find the simplicity and docility of heart which she had found in me. I felt it necessary that the gentle tranquillity of private and domestic life should make up to me for the loss of the brilliant career which I was renouncing. When I was quite alone, I felt a void in my heart, which it only needed another heart to fill. Destiny had deprived me of, or at least in part alienated me from, that heart for which nature had formed me. From that moment I was alone, for with me it has always been everything or nothing. I found in Thérèse the substitute that I needed. Thanks to her, I lived happily, as far as the course of events permitted. At first I tried to improve her mind, but my efforts were useless. Her mind is what nature has made it. Culture and teaching are without influence upon it. I am not ashamed to confess that she has never learned how to read properly, although she can write fairly well. When I went to live in the Rue Neuve des Petits Champs, opposite my windows at the Hôtel de Pontchartrain, there was a clock. For more than a month I did my utmost to teach her how to tell the time by it, but even now she can hardly do so. She has never been able to give the names of the 12 months of the year in correct order, and does not know a single figure, in spite of all the trouble I have taken to teach her. She can neither count money nor reckon the price of anything. The words which she uses in speaking are often the very opposite of those which she means. I once made a dictionary of the phrases she used to amuse Madame de Luxembourg, and her absurd mistakes have become famous in the society in which I lived. But this person, so limited in understanding, so stupid, if you will, is a most excellent adviser in cases of difficulty. Frequently in Switzerland, in England, and in France, at the time of the misfortunes which befell me, she saw what I did not see myself, gave me the best advice to follow, rescued me from dangers into which I was rushing blindly, and, in the presence of ladies of the highest rank, of princes and the great ones of the world, her opinions, her good sense, her answers, and her behaviour have gained for her the esteem of all, and for me compliments upon her good qualities, which I felt convinced were sincere. When we are with those we love, sentiment nourishes the mind as well as the heart, and we have little need to search for ideas elsewhere. I lived with my Thérèse as pleasantly as with the most brilliant genius in the world. Her mother, who prided herself on having been formerly brought up with the Marquise de Montpipeau, tried to play the wit and wanted to undertake the mental guidance of her daughter, and by her craftiness spoiled the simplicity of our intercourse. The annoyance which her importunity caused me made me, in some degree, get over the foolish shame which prevented me from venturing to show myself with Thérèse in public. And we took little walks together in the country, where we had little collations which were delightful to me. I saw that she loved me sincerely, and this increased my affection for her. This sweet intimacy made up for everything. I no longer felt any concern about the future, or at least I only thought of it as a prolongation of the present. I only desired to make sure that it would last. This attachment rendered all other recreation superfluous and insipid. I never went out except to visit Thérèse. Her place of abode became almost my own. This retired life proved so favourable to my work that in less than 3 months my opera, words, and music was finished, and nothing remained to be added except some accompaniments and a few tenor notes. Remplissage, the parts between bass and treble. This drudgery wearied me exceedingly. I proposed to Philidor to undertake it in return for a share of the profits. He came twice and put in a few notes in the act of Ovid, but he was unable to tie himself to a task which required such unremitting application, on the chance of remote and even doubtful profit. He did not come again, and I finished my task myself. My opera being ready, the next thing was to make some money by it, which was a far more difficult task. It is impossible for a man who lives a solitary life to succeed in Paris. I thought of making my way with the aid of Monsieur de la Poplinière, to whom I had been introduced by Gaufrecourt on my return from Geneva. Monsieur de la Poplinière was the Maecenas of Rameau. Madame de la Poplinière was his most humble pupil. Rameau was completely master in that house. Supposing that he would be glad to give his support to the work of one of his disciples, I wanted to show him mine. He refused to look at it, saying that he could not read scores. It was too fatiguing. La Poplinière suggested that it might be possible to get him to listen to it, and offered to get an orchestra together to perform selections. I desired nothing better. Rameau grumblingly consented, repeating incessantly that the composition of a man who had not been brought up to the profession, and who had learnt music entirely by himself, must be something fine. I hastened to copy out in parts 5 or 6 of the best passages. I had about 10 instrumentalists, Albert, Bérard, and Mademoiselle Bourdonnais being the vocalists. As soon as the overture commenced, Rameau, by his extravagant praises, intended to make it understood that the work could not be my own composition. He exhibited signs of impatience at every passage. But after a counter-tenor song, the execution of which was robust and powerful, and the accompaniment brilliant, he could no longer contain himself. He addressed me with a brutality which gave universal offence, and declared that part of what he had just heard was the work of a consummate master of the art, while the rest was by an ignorant fellow who did not even understand music. It is true that my work, uneven and irregular, was sometimes sublime and sometimes insipid, as must be the work of everyone who only elevates himself by flashes of genius without the support of scientific training. Rameau declared that he saw in me only a contemptible plagiarist, without talent or taste. The company present, and particularly the master of the house, thought differently. Monsieur de Richelieu, who at that time, as is well known, was a frequent visitor, heard of my work and wished to hear the whole of it played, intending, if it pleased him, to have it performed at court. It was performed with full chorus and orchestra, at the king's expense, at the house of Monsieur Bonneval, manager of the court amusements. Intendant des menus, plaisir, literally manager of the expenses connected with court ceremonies, festivals, and theatrical and other performances. Francoeur directed the performance, and the effect was surprising. The Duke was never tired of loudly expressing his approval, and at the end of a chorus in the act of Tasso, he got up from his seat, came over to me, shook me cordially by the hand, and said, "Monsieur Rousseau, that is a delightful harmony. I have never heard anything finer. I will have it performed at Versailles." Madame de la Poplinière, who was present, did not say a word. Rameau, although invited, had refused to come. The next day, Madame de la Poplinière received me very ungraciously at her toilette, pretended to depreciate my work, and told me that, although a little false glitter had dazzled Monsieur de Richelieu at first, he had recovered himself, and she advised me not to build any hopes upon my opera. The Duke arrived shortly afterwards and spoke to me in a quite different tone, flattered me upon my talents, and seemed still disposed to get my work performed before the King. "Only the act of Tasso would not be permitted at court," said he. "You must write another instead of it." These words alone were enough to make me go and shut myself up in my room, and in 3 weeks I had composed another act in place of Tasso, the theme of which was Hesiod, inspired by one of the Muses. I found means to introduce into the act part of the history of the developments of my talents, and of the jealousy with which Rameau had been pleased to honour them. In the new act the flight was less gigantic and better sustained than in Tasso. The music was equally grand, and the composition far superior. And if the other two acts had been equal to this, the whole piece might have been represented with success. But while I was putting the last touches upon it, another undertaking interrupted its execution. 1745 to 1747. During the winter, after the Battle of Fontenoy, several fêtes took place at Versailles, and several operas were performed at the Théâtre des Petites Écuries. Amongst these was Voltaire's drama, La Princesse de Navarre, set to music by Rameau, which had just been revised and the title changed to Les Fêtes de Ramire. This change of subject rendered several alterations necessary in the divertissement, both in the words and music. These are the incidental songs and dances. The question was to find someone capable of performing this twofold task, Voltaire and Rameau being in Lorraine, where they were both engaged on the opera of Le Temple de la Gloire, and consequently unable to give their attention to it. Monsieur de Richelieu thought of me, and proposed to me that I should undertake the task. And in order that I should be better able to judge what there was to be done, sent me the poem and the music separately. Before all, I was unwilling to touch the words without the author's consent, and I wrote to him on the subject a very polite and even respectful letter, as was only proper, and received the following answer, the original of which is to be found in the packet of papers, docketed A, number 1. December the 15th, 1745. Sir, two accomplishments, which have hitherto always been separated, are united in you. These are two good reasons why I should esteem and endeavour to love you. I am sorry, for your own sake, that you should employ these accomplishments upon a work which is none too worthy of you. Some months ago, Monsieur de Richelieu gave me strict orders to compose, at a moment's notice, a trifling and poor sketch of some insipid and unfinished scenes, which were to be adapted to divertissements utterly unsuited to them. I obeyed most scrupulously. I worked very rapidly and very badly. I sent the miserable skit to Monsieur de Richelieu, feeling sure that he would not make use of it, or that I should have to correct it. Happily, it is in your hands. You may do exactly what you please with it. I have entirely put it out of my sight. I have no doubt that you have corrected all the errors which must have occurred in the hasty composition of a simple sketch, and that you have filled in all that was wanting. I remember that, amongst other stupid blunders, I have forgotten to explain, in the scenes which connect the divertissement, how the Princess Grenadine is suddenly transported from a prison into a garden or palace. As it is not a magician, but a Spanish nobleman, who gives the festival in her honour, it seems to me that nothing ought to take place by enchantment. I beg you, sir, to look at this passage again, of which I have only a confused idea. See if it is necessary that the prison should open, and our princess be conducted from it to a beautiful, gilded and varnished palace, already prepared for her. I know that all this is very wretched stuff, and that it is beneath the dignity of a thinking being to make a serious business of such trifles. But since it is our duty to displease as little as possible, we must employ as much reason as we are able, even upon a miserable opera divertissement. I entirely depend upon you and Monsieur Ballot, and I trust soon to have the honour of thanking you, and of assuring you, sir, how I have the honour to be, etc., etc. There is nothing to cause surprise in the excessive politeness of this letter, compared with the almost rude tone of those which I have since then received from him. He thought I was high in favour with Monsieur de Richelieu, and his well-known courtly suppleness obliged him to show great politeness towards a newcomer, until he had become better acquainted with the measure of his importance. Authorized by Monsieur de Voltaire, and relieved from considering Rameau at all in the matter, since his only object was to injure me, I set to work, and in 2 months my task was executed. The poetry was a mere trifle. My only endeavour was to prevent the difference of style being noticed, and I was presumptuous enough to believe that I was successful. The music cost me more time and labour, besides being obliged to compose several introductory pieces, amongst others the overture. The whole of the recitative, which devolved upon me, presented very great difficulties, since I was obliged to connect, often in a few lines and by means of very rapid modulations, symphonies and choruses in very different keys. For in order that Rameau might not be able to accuse me of having spoilt his airs, I was determined not to alter or transpose a single one. The recitative was a success. It was well accented, full of vigour, and above all, admirably modulated. The idea of the two great men with whom I had the honour to be thus associated had elevated my genius, and I can say that in this thankless and inglorious task, of which the public could not even be informed, I nearly always kept myself up to the level of my models. The piece, as revised by me, was rehearsed at the Grand Theatre of the Opera. Of the three authors, I alone was present. Voltaire was away from Paris, and Rameau either did not come or kept himself hidden. The words of the first monologue were very melancholy. It began as follows. Au mort, viens terminer les malheurs de ma vie. I had been obliged to set it to appropriate music, and yet it was just this upon which Madame de la Poplinière founded her criticism, and accused me, with considerable bitterness, of having composed a funeral anthem. Monsieur de Richelieu judiciously began by inquiring who had written the words of the monologue. I showed him the manuscript which he had sent me, which proved that it was Voltaire. In that case, said he, Voltaire alone is to blame. During the rehearsal, all my work was disapproved of by Madame de la Poplinière and defended by Monsieur de Richelieu. But in the end I found the opposition too strong, and it was notified to me